Chapter 48. Few of us can stand prosperity. Another man's, I mean. Pudd'nhead Wilson's new calendar. The next picture in my mind is Government House, on Malabar Point, with the wide sea view from the windows and broad balconies. Abode of His Excellency the Governor of the Bombay Presidency, a residence which is European in everything but the native guards and servants, and is a home and a palace of state harmoniously combined. That was England, the English power, the English civilization, the modern civilization with the quiet elegancies, and quiet colors and quiet tastes and quiet dignity that are the outcome of the modern cultivation. And following it came a picture of the ancient civilization of India and our in the mansion of a native prince, Kumar Shri Samatsan Jai Bahadur of the Palatana state. The young lad, his heir, was with the prince. Also, the lad's sister, a wee brown sprite, very pretty, very serious, very winning, delicately molded, costumed like the daintiest butterfly, a dear little fairyland princess, gravely willing to be friendly with the strangers, but in the beginning preferring to hold her father's hand until she could take stock of them and determine how far they were to be trusted. She must have been 8 years old, so in the natural Indian order of things she would be a bride in 3 or 4 years from now, and then this free contact with the sun, and the air and the other belongings of outdoor nature and comradeship with visiting male folk would end, and she would shut herself up in the zenana for life, like her mother, and by inherited habit of mind would be happy in that seclusion and not look upon it as an irksome restraint and a weary captivity. The game which the prince amuses his leisure with, however, never mind it, I should never be able to describe it intelligibly. I tried to get an idea of it, while my wife and daughter visited the princess in the zenana, a lady of charming graces and a fluent speaker of English, but I did not make it out. It is a complicated game, and I believe it is said that nobody can learn to play it well but an Indian. And I was not able to learn how to wind a turban. It seemed a simple art and easy, but that was a deception. It is a piece of thin delicate stuff a foot wide or more, and 40 or 50 feet long, and the exhibitor of the art takes one end of it in his hands, and winds it in and out intricately about his head, twisting it as he goes, and in a minute or two the thing is finished, and is neat and symmetrical, and fits as snugly as a mold. We were interested in the wardrobe and the jewels, and in the silverware, and its grace of shape and beauty and delicacy of ornamentation. The silverware is kept locked up, except at meal times, and none but the chief butler and the prince have keys to the safe. I did not clearly understand why, but it was not for the protection of the silver. It was either to protect the prince from the contamination which his caste would suffer if the vessels were touched by low caste hands, or it was to protect his highness from poison. Possibly it was both. I believe a salaried taster has to taste everything before the prince ventures it, an ancient and judicious custom in the East, and has thinned out the tasters a good deal, for of course it is the cook that puts the poison in. If I were an Indian prince, I would not go to the expense of a taster, I would eat with the cook. Ceremonials are always interesting. And I noted that the Indian good-morning is a ceremonial, whereas ours doesn't amount to that. In salutation the son reverently touches the father's forehead with a small silver implement tipped with vermilion paste which leaves a red spot there, and in return the son receives the father's blessing. Our good morning is well enough for the rowdy West, perhaps, but would be too brusque for the soft and ceremonious East. After being properly necklaced, according to custom, with great garlands made of yellow flowers, and provided with betel nut to chew, this pleasant visit closed, and we passed thence to a scene of a different sort. From this glow of color and this sunny life to those grim receptacles of the Parsi dead, the Towers of Silence. There is something stately about that name, and an impressiveness which sinks deep. The hush of death is in it. We have the grave, the tomb, the mausoleum, God's acre, the cemetery, and association is made them eloquent with solemn meaning, but we have no name that is so majestic as that one, or lingers upon the ear with such deep and haunting pathos. On lofty ground, in the midst of a paradise of tropical foliage and flowers, remote from the world and its turmoil and noise, they stood the towers of silence, and away below was spread the wide groves of cocoa palms, then the city, mile on mile, then the ocean with its fleets of creeping ships all steeped in a stillness as deep as the hush that hallowed this high place of the dead. The vultures were there. They stood close together in a great circle all around the rim of a massive low tower waiting, stood as motionless as sculptured ornaments, and indeed almost deceived one into the belief that that was what they were. Presently there was a slight stir among the score of persons present, and all moved reverently out of the path and ceased from talking. A funeral procession entered the great gate, marching two and two, and moved silently by, toward the tower. The corpse lay in a shallow shell, and was under cover of a white cloth, but was otherwise naked. The bearers of the body were separated by an interval of 30 feet from the mourners. They, and also the mourners, were draped all in pure white, and each couple of mourners was figuratively bound together by a piece of white rope or a handkerchief, though they merely held the ends of it in their hands. Behind the procession followed a dog, which was led in a leash. When the mourners had reached the neighborhood of the tower, neither they nor any other human being, but the bearers of the dead, must approach within 30 feet of it, they turned and went back to one of the prayer houses within the gates, to pray for the spirit of their dead. The bearers unlocked the tower's sole door and disappeared from view within. In a little while they came out bringing the bier and the white covering cloth, and locked the door again. Then the ring of vultures rose, flapping their wings, and swooped down into the tower to devour the body. Nothing was left of it, but a clean picked skeleton, when they flocked out again a few minutes afterward. The principle which underlies and orders everything connected with a Parsi funeral is purity. By the tenets of the Zoroastrian religion, the elements, earth, fire, and water, are sacred, and must not be contaminated by contact with a dead body. Hence corpses must not be burned, neither must they be buried. None may touch the dead or enter the towers, where they repose except certain men who are officially appointed for that purpose. They receive high pay, but theirs is a dismal life, for they must live apart from their species, because their commerce with the dead defiles them, and any who should associate with them would share their defilement. When they come out of the tower, the clothes they are wearing are exchanged for others, in a building within the grounds, and the ones which they have taken off are left behind, for they are contaminated, and must never be used again, or suffered to go outside the grounds. These bearers come to every funeral in new garments. So far as is known, no human being, other than an official corpse bearer save one, has ever entered a tower of silence after its consecration. Just 100 years ago a European rushed in behind the bearers, and fed his brutal curiosity with a glimpse of the forbidden mysteries of the place. This shabby savage's name is not given, his quality is also concealed. These two details, taken in connection with the fact that for his extraordinary offense the only punishment he got from the East India Company's government was a solemn official reprimand, suggest the suspicion that he was a European of consequence. The same public document which contained the reprimand gave warning that future offenders of his sort, if in the company's service, would be dismissed, and if merchants, suffer revocation of license and exile to England. The towers are not tall, but are low in proportion to their circumference, like a gasometer. If you should fill a gasometer halfway up with solid granite masonry, then drive a wide and deep well down through the center of this mass of masonry, you would have the idea of a tower of silence. On the masonry surrounding the well the bodies lie, in shallow trenches which radiate like wheel-dash spokes from the well. The trenches slant toward the well, and carry into it the rainfall. Underground drains, with charcoal filters in them, carry off this water from the bottom of the well. When a skeleton is lain in the tower exposed to the rain, and the flaming sun a month it is perfectly dry and clean. Then the same bears that brought it there come gloved, and take it up with tongs, and throw it into the well. There it turns to dust. It is never seen again, never touched again, in the world. Other people separate their dead, and preserve and continue social distinctions in the grave the skeletons of kings and statesmen, and generals in temples and pantheons proper to skeletons of their degree, and the skeletons of the commonplace, and the poor in places suited to their meaner estate. But the Parsis hold that all men rank alike in death, all are humble, all poor, all destitute. In sign of their poverty they are sent to their grave naked, in sign of their equality the bones of the rich, the poor, the illustrious and the obscure are flung into the common well together. At a Parsi funeral there are no vehicles. All concerned must walk, both rich and poor, howsoever great the distance, to be traversed may be. In the wells of the five towers of silence is mingled the dust of all the Parsi men and women and children who have died in Bombay and its vicinity during the 2 centuries which have elapsed since the Mohammedan conquerors drove the Parsis out of Persia and into that region of India. The earliest of the five towers was built by the Madai family something more than 200 years ago, and it is now reserved to the heirs of that house. None but the dead of that blood are carried thither. The origin of at least one of the details of a Parsi funeral is not now known, the presence of the dog. Before a corpse is borne from the house of mourning it must be uncovered, and exposed to the gaze of a dog. A dog must also be led in the rear of the funeral. Mr. Nasirwan G. Byranaji, secretary to the Parsi Panchayat, said that these formalities had once had a meaning and a reason for their institution, but that they were survivals whose origin none could now account for. Custom and tradition continue them in force, antiquity hallows them. It is thought that in ancient times in Persia the dog was a sacred animal and could guide souls to heaven. Also that his eye had the power of purifying objects which had been contaminated by the touch of the dead, and that hence his presence with the funeral cortege provides an ever applicable remedy in case of need. The Parsis claim that their method of disposing of the dead is an effective protection of the living, that it disseminates no corruption, no impurities of any sort, no disease germs. That no wrap, no garment which has touched the dead is allowed to touch the living afterward. That from the towers of silence nothing proceeds which can carry harm to the outside world. These are just claims, I think. As a sanitary measure, their system seems to be about the equivalent of cremation, and as sure, we are drifting slowly but hopefully toward cremation in these days. It could not be expected that this progress should be swift, but if it be steady and continuous, even if slow, that will suffice. When cremation becomes the rule we shall cease to shudder at it. We should shudder at burial, if we allowed ourselves to think what goes on in the grave. The dog was an impressive figure to me, representing as he did a mystery whose key is lost. He was humble, and apparently depressed. And he let his head droop pensively, and looked as if he might be trying to call back to his mind what it was that he had used to symbolize ages ago when he began his function. There was another impressive thing close at hand, but I was not privileged to see it. That was the sacred fire, a fire which is supposed to have been burning without interruption for more than 2 centuries. And so, living by the same heat that was imparted to it so long ago. The Parsis are a remarkable community. There are only about 60,000 in Bombay, and only about half as many as that in the rest of India, but they make up in importance what they lack in numbers. They are highly educated, energetic, enterprising, progressive, rich, and the Jew himself is not more lavish or Catholic in his charities and benevolences. The Parsis build and endow hospitals for both men and animals, and they and their womenkind keep an open purse for all great and good objects. They are a political force, and a valued support to the government. They have a pure and lofty religion, and they preserve it in its integrity, and order their lives by it. We took a final sweep of the wonderful view of plain and city and ocean, and so ended our visit to the garden and the Towers of Silence. And the last thing I noticed was another symbol, a voluntary symbol this one. It was a vulture standing on the sawed-off top of a tall and slender and branchless palm in an open space in the ground. He was perfectly motionless, and looked like a piece of sculpture on a pillar. And he had a mortuary look too, which was in keeping with the place. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.